when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode discusses offences of violence, up to and including murder, and discussions of missing persons. So listener discretion is advised.
Well, hello, Joe.
Hello, Lizzie. How are you?
I am very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well.
Excellent. So today I have picked the topic.
Mm-hmm.
And in broad terms, I want to talk today about coroner courts.
Yes.
And inquests.
Yes.
Because, you know, we have talked a little bit about some coroner findings in various cases that we have discussed.
Yep.
I guess that sort of piqued my interest. I hadn't really read a lot of coroner court findings before, and they're so well written and so clearly set out all of the pertinent facts and evidence and all of that sort of thing. So I really liked reading them. But then I was thinking to myself, what use do we make of these? So I thought we'd talk about that a little bit, particularly in light of the fact that there was quite a famous case where the inquest concluded and the findings were handed down last week of Marion Barter, who was a Gold Coast woman who went missing in the 90s. So I want to talk about it in that respect.
Absolutely. Okay. Jump in.
Jump in. But so the first thing I thought is just to get a little bit of an understanding of what a coroner's court is, because you don't often hear about them, maybe a little bit more these days, but you never used to hear about them that much. The website says that an inquest is the coroner's public face, an open and transparent inquiry that scrutinizes events leading to a reportable death and provides an opportunity for coroners to make comments that can be powerful catalysts for broad systemic reform. So the coroner court can't lay charges. They can't find anyone guilty. They can't hold anyone civilly liable for anything, but they can make findings and they can make recommendations. And sometimes those recommendations are systemic. You know, police should incorporate this, or hospitals should be incorporating different practices for workplace health and safety. You know, so they're recommendations about matters that affect public safety, health, yeah. interest.
Well, I mean, the people might remember there was big coronial inquests into quad bikes and making recommendations about quad bikes because so many people had died using them.
I did not know that.
Oh, didn't you? I had a friend who got a gig on that, and it was an inquiry. Each state did a similar coronial inquest so that they could make recommendations about those quad bikes, and they've been effectively outlawed. Oh, I think you've got to have a roll cage on them now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yes, yeah, so broad interests and recommendations. Mm. So then I looked and I found that a death must be reported to the coroner, not necessarily for an inquest to be held, but must be reported to the coroner if there's been a violent or unnatural death or someone has died suddenly and the cause is unknown.
Mm.
If a medical practitioner has not issued a certificate stating the cause of death, if the deceased person was not attended by a medical practitioner within 6 months before they died, if they died in circumstances where it was not reasonably expected for them to die in relation to a health-related procedure, if they die while being provided with care, treatment, or assistance while in certain establishments such as hospitals, residential centres, welfare facilities, or residential childcare centres, or... and this, I think, is a big one, any person who has died in police custody or while in a prison or detention centre.
Mm.
In those cases, there must be an inquest.
Yep.
That's the only time it's mandatory.
Yeah.
So an inquest is not a trial by any means, but it is an opportunity for a coroner to hold a hearing and they are assisted by a lawyer who is called counsel assisting.
Mm-hmm.
And so people involved in the case, whether it be, you know, hospital staff or police witnesses or whatever, are called and they are questioned. And different to a criminal trial, you can be compelled to give evidence and to answer questions in a coroner's court. So, for example, if you are an accused person or a person of interest who cannot be compelled necessarily to speak to police or to give evidence in a criminal hearing, a coroner has the right to call you, ask you questions and make you answer them.
You can claim the right to silence, presumably, though.
I don't think you can because the evidence, I think it's a bit like the CCC, like the Crime and Corruption Commission. Mm. I think it's that you have to give the answers, but what you say cannot be used against you in criminal proceedings.
Mm.
And derivative evidence, so evidence that is gleaned through things you have said cannot be used. But things you say can be used against other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a bit of an anomaly in that way, in that there are much broader powers for the inquiry itself, but the outcome doesn't really have teeth per se.
Yeah. From a lawyer's point of view, they're an interesting beast because in a trial, you know, the judge or magistrate is an impartial observer effectively. They make the decision, but they just, you know, the parties decide who the witnesses are going to be.
Yes.
And the parties, you know, they call their witnesses and cross-examine them. Whereas in an inquest, it's the coroner through the counsel assisting, but they run the whole proceeding so that if you're an interested party, as you've described, you can be represented in that you can have a lawyer. So you're compelled to go on evidence. You can turn up with your own lawyer.
Yes.
But, you know, it's the coroner through the counsel assisting who really is running the whole thing.
Well, and also the converse, if someone thinks that they are an interested party in a matter, they can come and say, I want to talk to you.
Yeah.
And you don't get that opportunity in a criminal court.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I also found out that one of the big functions beyond, sadly, deaths in custody, another really big function is inquiring into missing persons cases. And so I don't know if you knew this, but about 38,000 people are reported missing each year to police. Most people are found within a short period of time, but if you've been missing for more than 3 months, you have reached a particular category of missing person.
Yeah.
And there are about 2,600 people who have been missing for more than 3 months.
Wow.
There are numerous websites devoted to missing persons, and it is, like, I looked at one and it was literally pages of these photos that just break your heart because some of them are very old.
Yeah.
And Some of them are new, you know.
But so how do they get before a coroner? Because presumably the coroner's court doesn't want to do 2,000 inquests.
Yes. So when there has been someone who's missing under accidental, unexplained or suspicious circumstances, mm-hmm. and there is a belief that that person may be deceased, the case may be referred to the coroner.
Right. Okay.
Police may refer it to the coroner to ascertain whether there are other forms of inquiry that can be pursued rather than a police investigation, I guess, because they have these broader powers. So not all cases that are referred to the coroner will result in an inquest, but often the family or friends of the missing persons are keen for an inquest to be held. And when that is the case, it will usually be granted.
Mm.
So there are a lot of missing person inquests.
Yeah.
So the one that hit the news recently was the case of Marion Barta.
Mm.
Now, there is another podcast all about this called The Lady Vanishes. And being a podcast fan, I actually listened to that from the start. So I've been quite interested in this case as it unfolded.
Mm.
But this case goes back to 1997, and the inquest itself did take quite a long time. There were a number of different hearing days. There were delays between it starting and then finishing. And the main driver in pursuing this missing persons case is her daughter, Sally. So Marion had two children, Sally and Owen. Unfortunately, Owen died some years ago.
Mm.
And Sally has been just relentless in trying to find out what happened to her mum. Ever since 97, she has been looking.
How and old so, was she when her mother went missing?
Well, she must have been, I'm guessing early 20s, because she was due to be married the next year after her mother went missing, and she did get married the next year. So she wasn't a little girl. She wasn't, I don't think, even a teenager, but she was young. So I thought we could talk a little bit about the Marion Barta case. Marion was a teacher. She taught at the Southport School here on the Gold Coast, TSS.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very good teacher. I know that she had won some state or national award the year before she went missing. And everyone who talked about her knew that she loved to teach. But then at the start of 1997, there was a shift in her employment. There was some issues, I think, with some other staff members, and Marion decided to resign, and she was going to do an overseas trip.
Mm-hmm.
So she had talked about this for some time. She had planned it. She did tender her resignation, and she was going to put her house up for sale. She gave her car to her daughter, and her daughter was going to sell her own car and give Marion the money. So there was a lot of plans in place for this overseas holiday.
Sorry, before we go any further, so she got two children. Had she been married and divorced? Or?
Yeah, so she had been married to some famous sports guy, Johnny Warren.
Oh, Johnny Warren, okay.
Yes.
Rugby and league.
She had travelled with him overseas.
Okay.
That marriage ended, and I think she had been married a second time. People said she loved to be in a relationship,
mm-hmm.
But she was not married to anybody at the time.
No.
She went missing. So Sally was aware of these plans. Marion's friends, her sister, were aware of these plans. They weren't entirely sure what was driving it, but clearly she'd made up her mind. And she had said she might go for 12 months. Maybe she would teach while she was over there. She wasn't sure, but, you know, she had grand plans. Mm. One of the things she was really excited about doing was going on the Orient Express.
Oh, wow.
You know, so, and she wanted to go to like Jane Austen.
Oh, house, you know, and
that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
She was due to leave in June 1997.
Mm-hmm.
She was meant to be gone for about 12 months. Sally was getting married October 98, and they fully expected she would be back for her daughter's wedding. So that was fine. She went on the holiday. She sent some postcards, a letter while she was away. There were a couple of phone calls. So remember pre-internet.
Yeah.
A couple of phone calls and then nothing. She literally just didn't communicate again after the 31st of July, mm-hmm. I think it was, in 1997.
Yep.
And so quite quickly, Sally thought, well, this is weird. Mm. I talk to Mum all the time. You know, something's happening. And after a little bit of time, she inquired with her mum's bank, just as a welfare kind of check, mm. has there been activity? And I don't think this would happen today, but the bank teller told her that there had been regular withdrawals mm-hmm. from the mum's account. There's a little bit of discrepancy. Was it $500 or $5,000 each time? But anyway, regular withdrawals, and they had been from the Byron Bay branch.
Wow.
Since August of 1997, which suggested she was there in person. So so Sally was like, okay, this is weird. She went and reported it to the police. So the initial police investigation, they took account of what Sally told them, that she'd planned the holiday, she'd sold her house, she'd resigned from her job, she'd communicated from overseas. And so then they got in contact with the bank, the officer in charge, and the bank teller said, yep, she made a withdrawal, I saw her. And so the police officer wrote on the file, located, safe and well.
Yeah. I have a lot of problems with that identification. I think, you know, it's so unreliable. You know, the courts have given some directions about how reliable an identification is of somebody who's a stranger to you and you see on one occasion. So I don't know, you know, I'd be love to know how much later after this alleged withdrawal the bank teller was asked to identify, and was he shown a photo of Marion Barter and said, did this woman withdraw money? Because, you know, that's you're immediately, you know, contaminating his memory as soon as you show pictures.
I don't think they even showed a picture. I think they said, well, who made the withdrawal? And they said, well, our practice is it has to be the account holder.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's, that wouldn't really, I mean, I suppose it'd be some evidentiary value in a court hearing, but yeah, it's not great, is it? I mean,
Well, and I hadn't realised, but with a missing persons case, if the police take up the investigation and they locate the missing person and that missing person says, I don't want to go back to my family, the police cannot provide any information beyond the fact that they are safe and well.
Wow, okay.
So there is this very strong right of a person to completely disappear from their life, start fresh.
Yep.
They're not doing anything wrong.
No.
And their family and friends have no rights to know beyond the fact they're alive. That's it.
Yeah.
Which I understand the reasoning for that, but gosh, how hard is that for the family?
Yeah, very hard, particularly I suspect for children.
Very difficult.
But is that the only evidence that she's back in Australia?
So originally that was, I think, what they looked at. There was, I'd like to say, some cursory investigations with airlines and border control and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, because 97, you are filling out a card as you re-enter.
That's right.
And those cards, nowadays they're scanned. It's amazing. You sort of think, oh, nobody'd ever keep this.
Yeah.
But my wife is a barrister. She's done some work for the Border Force and they scan them all and keep them. So they can pull up the card that you fill out.
And they did.
Wow, they did
find it. They did find it. But so back in October 97, police found out from the AFP that Marion had returned to Australia on the 2nd of August 1997. Right. And so they knew she was back. They confirmed that she'd been alive and well at the bank and said she obviously doesn't want contact with you. She's entitled. And so the file said occurrence only rather than missing persons.
Yeah.
Which means that there's nothing to investigate.
And so they didn't actually ask her. They just assume she doesn't want to contact her family.
Well, because they never spoke to her.
Yeah. That's,
they never spoke to her. But the file says LOCSAW, located, safe and well. Occurrence only, no further investigation, no action to be taken.
Yeah.
Okay. There was further contact with police by Sally in November of that same year. Another report was made. Inquiries were made into her whereabouts at that time with immigration and the bank. And then they said located safe and well. The next entry was from December. Detailed police had had a conversation with Marion's dad and they informed him that there was nothing further they could do to locate her. So it wasn't just Sally overreacting.
No.
All of the family were concerned. She was close to her family. It was very unlike her. She missed her son's birthday that year, didn't contact him, you know, all of these things. So then in...
And the daughter's wedding's looming, is it?
The next October.
Right.
Then early the next year, the dad went to the Salvation Army Missing Persons Bureau to say he was worried about his daughter. He included in his memo to them that Sally had applied to the Missing Persons Unit but had been told Marion was entitled to her privacy and did not wish to have her whereabouts divulged and that she had been contacted. That was not true.
No.
The Salvation Army Missing Persons Bureau then made a note in March that they had spoken to police who confirmed that the security officer at Marion's bank had confirmed she was definitely the person who made the withdrawal and conveyed to the teller she was starting a new life. So we've embellished on what the bank teller's evidence is now.
But, so that's not new evidence. That's just a further description of what they already said, or is that
new? That was the first record, written record, that the teller said she wanted to start a new life.
Yeah. But again, not great. You've got to, presumably the police got to actually get it from the person themselves as opposed to a hearsay from a bank teller.
And so that was the end of it for a really long time. Just nothing. No police investigation, no further contact from Marion at all. So Sally never stopped believing that she was missing and that she wanted to find her. So in 2007, so nine years later, the matter was again looked at by a different officer with the missing persons unit who had been asked to assist the investigation in conjunction with the local area liaison. So Sally had gone back to the local police. And the investigations at that time referred to Marion as going missing on the 30th of August, but she wasn't on the missing persons register.
Mm.
So the AFP missing persons unit then contacted the New South Wales missing persons unit and it was recategorized from occurrence only to missing person. So this is now 10 years after she went missing.
Yeah.
Various notes on the file showed some inquiries were made between 2007 and 2009, but nothing new was uncovered. In June 2009, the officer who had carriage of the case made a note on the file, delayed due to work commitments of a higher priority.
Mm.
So it says a lot about the attitude to this case. And then in December.
Although, I mean, I'm not usually the one who champions the police, but I, you know, if you think of the statistics we started with, that there's 22,000 or whatever, you know, reports and
38,000.
Sorry, 38,000 reports in a year. And most of those people turn up. Well.
I know. But is it a risk you can take?
But you can appreciate, I absolutely agree that the police should have done more. But you can see an officer who gets this file after a few years and nobody else has been able to do anything with it. And he gets other work that's important and he's like missing people, you know, either they turn up all the time or once they've been missing more than 3 months, you never find them, you know. I've got other things to do. I'm not justifying it, but I can understand it.
I know, but then I put myself in Sally's position. Yeah. I'd be like, just look for her, damn it, you know?
Yeah.
Or where is the proof you spoke to her back in 97?
Yeah. And that's, you know? Yeah. And when you talk to criminologists and investigating police, they say that. And if you, unless you, you know, get the leads early, the trail goes cold and you just never find them.
And this case is bizarre on so many levels.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if the police would have had a better outcome at the time. But the fact that it wasn't done properly makes you think, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Anyway, so a new officer got it in 2009. Not all information pertinent to the case made it to the new officer. A number of inquiries were made into bank accounts, travel information, name changes, which I'll come back to. Ooh. And then finally, they took a statement from Sally in May 2010 and the officer in charge submitted a report the following September 2011. recommending that Marion be removed from the missing persons database on the basis there was evidence to show she had taken steps to change her identity and was not a missing person.
Oh.
So that was approved and her status was officially changed to located, and the investigation was formally suspended in November 2011.
Again, they say located, you know, you'd want to have a couple of other options, like didn't actually sight her but think she's probably
fine.
That's
right,
you know.
That's right. So how did all of this happen?
Yeah.
So driven, I say, by the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, the travel they did, the people they spoke to. But so it turns out that Marion, back before she moved overseas or went on her overseas holiday, had changed her name by deed poll and got a new driver's license and a new passport in her new name, which was Florabella Natalia Marion Remichel.
Wow, that is a real
very
mouthful.
Unusual name.
Yeah.
And Remichel is a very unusual surname in Australia.
Yes.
So once that piece of information was uncovered, which I think the police found through AFP, and they got her airport cards. And so she said when she left Australia, she was leaving, that she was a housewife, that she was going to Luxembourg, I'm pretty sure.
An interesting destination.
Yes. And then they also have her card from when she came back, and she said she was married and she was a housewife.
Wow, okay.
And she was here for a visit from Luxembourg. So there were these clues.
Yes.
Okay. So this massive
story. I did not expect Luxembourg to come into this podcast.
No, and the other podcast people went to Luxembourg to track down who they thought might have known, but it turns out that the man who really did have contact with Marion had borrowed the name of a man from Luxembourg.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it is. It has more twists and turns. Like it was episodes and episodes that
everyone
uncovered
in Luxembourg
all of
this. Scratching their head, thinking we can't follow any of this.
So in light of all of this, there was some leads that could be followed.
Mm.
This name of Remichel, this connection to Luxembourg. In 2016, Sally, still determined to find her mum, reported her as missing at a Queensland police station. All of the other reports had been New South Wales.
Okay.
And in February 2018, the New South Wales officer who had signed off the investigation was alerted to the fact that there was a ministerial file open, and he reopened the case in January 2019.
Reopened the case in New South Wales?
Yes.
Okay.
Because there must have been this interest in the case, administratively flagged it, you know, we want to know what's happened. And so he thought, okay, I'll reopen
the case. But a ministerial file, you mean the police minister or the...
Yeah, I guess so.
Sally must have had some...
sway.
...connections.
Well, I think she had uncovered some things that bore looking into, you know, and so that's what happened with the podcast. And simultaneously, there is now this reopened case in 2019.
Yes.
So podcast 2019,
yes.
Reopening of the case.
Yes.
And then the inquest began in 2021.
Yes.
Okay.
In Lismore, I understand.
Yeah. Yep.
Because her last known address was in Byron Bay.
Well, in that area.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. The inquest.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Took on evidence or information that had been gleaned through the podcast. And the biggest one of these was this man called Rick Bloom.
Yes.
And it turns out that Bloom, and he was called by the coroner to give evidence. He was a very reluctant witness.
Mm-hmm.
He had been spoken to by police a number of times by the time he gave evidence at the inquest.
When you say he was a reluctant witness, I think he was pretty ill. He was living in a home, isn't he? And he's
He did not want to answer questions.
Okay. That mightn't mean anything necessarily.
And he changed his story like from one day of the inquest to the next.
Okay.
Did not
give at the inquest.
Yes.
Okay, that's not
did
great.
Did not give consistent evidence at all. And so what came out about Mr. Bloom was that he had a history of criminal offending, including fraud, forgery, confidence tricks, false identity, larceny, embezzlement, breach of trust, use of false documents, and false impersonation. A lot of his criminal record was from France, and he served 4 years in custody in France.
Wow.
In 1971, in the 1970s.
Okay. Well, he must have been very young in 71. But interesting.
He's very old now.
Yes. But that, see, that's a really interesting aspect of coronial inquests. Criminal histories do not come out for people who are, you know, potentially accused of things in a trial at all.
Not at all.
So.
Oh, well, you'll love even more what else came out at the inquest.
Yeah.
The coroner had detailed evidence from four women.
Oh, yes.
Who said that Rick Bloom, in one name or another, had preyed upon them.
Yes.
For financial gain.
Yes. So is this catfishing? Somebody said catfishing. I think it's the old version
of catfishing.
Right.
Mm. So he would follow the same pattern where he would prey on a vulnerable woman and woo them, you know, the love bombing of today,
right,
and have grand plans for marriage or a business venture. And
yes,
they were going to live together forever, and then he would get money from them and then he'd be gone, ghosted them.
Right. Okay.
Meanwhile, he had a wife and children the whole time.
Okay. That's an interesting, I didn't expect that to come up. Okay. So can I just take a step back? I can't see the connection between him and...
I didn't tell you.
Okay. That's good. I felt like I missed something.
No, sorry. I should say. So we know that she changed her name to Florabella Remickel.
Right.
So somehow through these trawls of everything on the podcast, they found this advertisement, because Remickel was such a strange or unusual name. Yeah. They found an advertisement that had been placed in, I think, a French version of the Courier Mail advertising for romance, you know, like Tinder in the newspaper.
Right. Well,
and it
Tinder
was
before Tinder, yeah.
An F.M. Remickel who'd placed the ad.
Right.
And so that's what took them to Luxembourg. They tried to find the real F.M. Remickel. And they spoke to his wife. They did not want to speak to anyone.
No.
And she had known Rick Bloom.
Right.
And so then there was this connection to Rick Bloom. I think she turned them on to him. And so then they got on to Rick Bloom. They found out that he had a whole lot of different personas. They were able to place him in northern New South Wales at the right time. And, you know, and there had been a suggestion that Marion had met someone new right before she left, but she kept him a secret and sold the house and all of this sort of thing, you know, really made these big decisions beyond just the trip overseas. Sold the house, sold the car, resigned.
Right.
You
know. Okay, but so if she meets him in Australia, what is the relevance then of the French Courier Mail version of the...
Well, he was foreign.
Okay, so he's...
He was foreign.
Right.
And he'd come here with his wife and children,
but
he was constantly traveling,
right,
constantly going overseas. And so there was then evidence that he had left and returned to Australia within days of Marion's departure and return to Australia in 1997.
Yes.
He had gone via Japan. Marion had written a letter to her daughter on stationery from the hotel that Remickel had stayed at, that Bloom had stayed at,
right,
at that time. You know, so there were all of these little connections,
yes,
that all were starting to make sense.
Sure. But the fact that he'd come back well before she came back.
Just a couple of days.
I thought he
within days of each other, they left and departed.
Right, I see. Okay.
I mean, left and returned.
Left and returned, yes. Right.
And so anyway, when he's spoken to by police all these years later, he said, yeah, I knew Marion.
Yeah.
He admits it.
Yes.
He said, no, she didn't answer my ad, though. She'd placed an ad looking for adventure, and I answered that. And we only met 3 times. Yes, it was in 97, and then I never saw her again. Right. Oh, no, yeah, I did store some furniture for her, but, you know, no, I never saw her again. I don't know what happened to her. She told me she wanted to start a new life. So all of this came out in dribs and drabs.
Right.
And so not very believable. And
where's he storing the furniture? In France or in?
No, in his property here, tea right. chests.
Oh, so the police search and they find some of her property.
Well, he said that was the last time they saw each other. You know, so it was all, he did not give consistent versions of anything.
No.
So the women came and said, yes, under whatever name, he did exactly the same to me, but I am still here to tell the story. We don't know what happened to Marion. Yeah,
no.
But $80,000 was the final withdrawal, and he opened a safe deposit envelope the week before or the couple of days before she withdrew that $80,000.
In the same bank or somewhere?
A different bank, but the inference was...
He put cash into his safe deposit box.
The police still have not... found her.
No.
They haven't really got any further with Rick Bloom. I mean, they've interviewed him, but the coroner found that he had an intimate relationship with Marion in 97 and he persuaded or encouraged her to sell her house. So these are the findings that have been recorded. Okay,
so he's on the Gold Coast.
He's all over the place, but yes, he came up to the Gold Coast.
Right.
Start of 97 in response to Marion's ad.
Right.
But then he also contradicted himself on that and said she responded to his ad. Like, he's a liar.
So she had posted an ad in Australia.
He said that.
Right.
Nobody else knows about it. Right. He also tried to say she was dating a pilot. You know, like,
okay.
He is just a liar through and through.
Okay. Well, his stories are inconsistent.
Allegedly.
His stories are inconsistent. I think we can say that. Yep.
So another finding of the coroner, that she withdrew all of the money in August and October 97 on the encouragement of Bloom and in circumstances where she believed she was in a relationship with him. So the coroner was convinced of that.
Wow. I mean, I know you haven't had a chance to go through all the evidence, but that's the coroner making findings about what the missing person was thinking and motivated by. That's a big call, I think.
Finding that Bloom was in communication with Marion and played some role in her life on her return to Australia in August 97.
Okay.
A finding that he has further knowledge of many aspects of the case and is deliberately unwilling to divulge this knowledge to the court.
Okay. Interesting.
Did have a finding in relation to the police that the nature and adequacy of the police investigation between 97 and 2019 was not adequate and very little was done.
Yep.
And there were significant deficiencies and inadequacies in the police processes, which have now been remedied in relation to missing persons.
Oh, they've changed. So did the coroner make some recommendations about police processes? Yep. Wow.
And well, they only came down now, but since Marion's case, those processes have been changed already.
Right. Okay.
So she noted they'd been changed.
Yes, okay. Well, that's good.
She also made ultimate findings in relation to Marion that on the balance of probabilities, Florabella Remickel, formerly Marion Barter, is deceased.
Yes.
She died sometime after October 98. She found that any referral of Bloom to the DPP to consider charges of perjury is best left to police investigators.
Yes.
And I thought it was interesting she included that. Might be a little hint there.
Oh, it's not a very big hint. That's a pretty, they can say much more strident things than that.
And then a recommendation that the New South Wales Police investigation into the death of missing person Florabella Remickel be referred to the Unsolved Homicide Team.
Yeah. Okay, so there's more investigations to be done.
And they interviewed Sally and said, you know, it's been such a long time. You know, how do you feel? And she said, well, I feel like I now can say Mum is dead and I haven't been able to say that. And I know obviously she would love there to be a body found or justice of some kind, but I guess even that measure of comfort from the coroner's findings is – you know, so important.
Yeah. Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, I read all of that and I thought, you can see. Well, I felt like the coroner was like, Bloom, whatever you say it, he's a bad egg.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he's skating through, is what I think.
Wow, I didn't get that. No, okay. Why do you think he's skating through?
I think it'd be very, very difficult to charge him.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree.
So my point is, it doesn't matter what the coroner finds that he was with her the day she died. You know, it doesn't mean anything for Bloom.
Oh, well, I mean, it means he's been, we know his name and we know where he lives, and I'm sure.
But consequence-wise, well, justice-wise, what does it mean?
Well, you know, I mean, in terms of justice, you know, in terms of the criminal justice system, it doesn't mean too much. In terms of cosmic justice, I don't know, because it's not really up to us. Well, I don't know that.
He's still living his life. And I think I would like to see coroner's findings have more teeth, because I agree with so much of what these coroners are saying.
Well, but if you disagreed, then you wouldn't want them to have more teeth?
No.
I just think that, I think the coroner's court plays a absolutely crucial role in our criminal justice system. But part of the, you know, the rules of evidence are what don't exist or are much less, and it has an ability to do things that you can't do in a court.
Yes.
And so it can create a level of unfairness to people.
Well, yes, and it has only the balance of probabilities.
Balance of probabilities,
although it's
yes,
a sliding scale, the more serious the offence, the closer or the further away from, you know,
the more reliable the evidence I've got to
that's
be to
right.
Yeah, make the call. Yeah, agree, but you know, okay. I don't think there's any, you know,
so
giving them
me,
more power. I
mean, well, so let me tell you the other one that gets me.
Sure.
And we've talked about Shandy Blackburn before in the context of the DNA lab.
Yes.
But what we didn't really get into was the fact that after she was murdered in 2013, there was a police investigation, very detailed police investigation, and one of Shandy's ex-boyfriends, a guy called John Peros, was charged with her murder, and he went to trial and he was acquitted, not guilty. Let me just note, there was no DNA evidence because the DNA labs got it all wrong.
Okay.
And there was a lot of evidence that was ruled inadmissible in terms of text messages, which provided context to their relationship and the breakdown of that relationship and his attitude to that. And the jury didn't see any of that either. That happened, and there was an inquest held in 2019 and the findings were delivered in 2020. The trial had been a couple of years earlier. And so John Peros is out and about, acquitted, not guilty. So again, because the coroner in this case had broader powers, a lot of evidence, like all of those text messages and context of the relationship and all of that, all went before the coroner. The coroner had the opportunity to investigate or inquire into these other potential persons of interest in the case, and was able to discount all of them. And
well, when you say was able to discount
all
of them,
I am, because that, the findings of the coroner were Shandy Blackburn died due to injuries sustained in an incident involving violence with John Peros, who used a bladed instrument.
Okay.
So she found he killed her.
Okay. Yeah,
or he
sure.
found. He found. That might have been a him.
Yeah.
The coroner went on to say, in stating that, the coroner is not making any statement, nor can it be inferred that John Peros is guilty of any offence nor civilly liable for something. This is not a criminal trial nor a civil action.
No.
The coroner said, I understand the seriousness and ramifications of these findings and did not reach them lightly. I felt an actual and definite persuasion towards these conclusions and believe there is no other possible reasonable explanation. So to me, that is frustrating because, and I probably should be careful, because John Peros is suing all and sundry for defamation for publicity about him being the potential killer of Shandy Blackburn.
Yep.
So he has been found not guilty in a court of law. There is no charge currently against him. I find it frustrating that a coroner with access to all of the evidence and all of the information decided that that was the cause of Shandy's death.
I've got some issues with the way you
tell
put that.
Tell me what's
okay. Problem. Well, when you say all of the evidence, we have developed, you know, over a course of 800 years, laws of evidence, which some of which have been codified in Queensland, to protect the rights of defendants. And so that, you know, ruling material inadmissible, you know, means that it has been determined that it is not appropriate for it to go before a jury. Now, the coroner can have reference to it for what they do, fine. But that doesn't mean that, you know, when you say all of the evidence presupposes that, you know, had the jury had all of this, then they definitely would have convicted him.
Oh, 100%.
You know, well, we don't know that. But my point is that's our system of justice, and I have no problems with it. Well, I mean, I did a doctoral thesis on evidence, so I've got a soft spot for the laws of evidence. But, you know, I think this is part of the problem with the coroner's court. Let me give you another coroner's court story.
Mm.
Okay, so in 1981, the coroner finds that Azaria Chamberlain is killed by a dingo.
I know.
In 1983 or something, that coroner's findings are put aside, and the next coroner finds that Zari was murdered by, Lindy Chamberlain and Michael, and they're put on trial and convicted. Then, you know, there's a commissioner inquiry, convictions overturned, turns out they're innocent. Then there's another coronial inquest which says that Azaria Chamberlain was killed by persons unknown. So still doesn't accept that it was a dingo, yeah. Still accept that she was murdered. That's finally set aside, and finally a fourth coronial inquest goes back to the original one and says Azaria Chamberlain is taken by a dingo.
I know. And I wanted to flag that as well. And in fact, the coroner in February 81, the first one, concluded the finding that the dingo had taken the baby by saying it was the easiest decision of his career.
Yes. I think that was a little inflammatory to the Northern Territory Police. Said about having his decision set aside. And he televised it too, which was also
a bit inflammatory. But so this is where I get frustrated, because if that decision of the coroner, that first decision in the case of Azaria Chamberlain, had any weight or teeth, then maybe that would have been it for Lindy and Michael. Because I guess I wonder, what's the point of being able to make these findings, which you can say they're not findings of guilt all you like, or well, they are. They're findings of fact in relation to guilt or innocence.
Well, yeah, but they're not binding on a court.
No, they're not binding. But so my question is, then why? Why can they do it? Because they can't make the DPP or the police do anything from that point. They're only recommendations.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think that ability to recommend is so important. And they do, as you point out, identify some systemic problems in a whole range of things.
That function is very,
very important.
Important, yes. And well done. So I think what we're going to find, and so there was two other cases I won't go into in any depth, but one of them was Theo Hayes, who was the backpacker, 18-year-old backpacker who went missing in Byron Bay.
Mm.
And he has never been found.
Is this another podcast or?
No. Yeah. Oh, maybe it was.
Okay.
Anyway, I just read about it.
Yeah.
But he's never been found, and his family came from Belgium, and it was very sad, really horrible case.
Mm.
There was the police in that case did an intense investigation, but there was technology involved here, iPhone, Google timelines, Google Maps, passwords to social media, and the police actually weren't sure what their rights were in terms of accessing some of that, and so there were delays while they put in requests, and the family had brought them passwords and they said, we can't legally access that. So one of the good things out of that case is it shone a light on the need for policing to be modernized and be very aware of what they can and cannot do and access to what, you know, for quicker responses and CCTV footage.
I don't know why they couldn't just subpoena them.
Well, the timing, I think, was the problem.
Maybe if there wasn't a coronial inquest on foot, they probably couldn't subpoena. Anyway.
Anyway, so that was, you know, that was a good thing that came out of that. The coroner in that case couldn't determine who might have injured Theo, or if he had misadventure or whatever. So that wasn't
the point. When you don't have
a
body, these questions are very difficult to answer.
But then the other one, and I think this is probably where we're heading with missing person findings like Marion Barter or like Shandy Blackburn, this was a really old case of Lucille Butterworth. She disappeared in 1969 The police investigated again. She was seen at a bus stop. There were witnesses who saw her. She was a beautiful young woman. She was engaged to be married. They investigated the fiancé and cleared him. People saw her speaking to someone in a car. They tried to track down the car because the car and she had both disappeared and, you know, all of this. So it was quite a comprehensive investigation, but it didn't really get anywhere.
Yeah.
And then some years later, in 75, I think, another man or a man got arrested for the rape and murder of another woman.
Yeah.
And he made full confessions to that. And during that police interview, the police officers thought, this is a bit weird. He could be the guy for Lucille.
Yeah.
And so they asked him questions. They said, we actually want to talk to you about something else. And he said something like, oh, yeah, I know. What about? Yeah, I gave her a lift that day. So knew that they were talking about Lucille.
Okay.
Apparently made these confessions that he had picked her up. He was taking her for a lift. And he said that she complained of a cramp in her foot. He pulled the car over. He said, come here. She struggled. He strangled her. And then he disposed of the body.
Okay.
But a different police officer, more superior, had in his mind that there was someone else who was good for Lucille's disappearance. The police notes were very patchy, didn't include all of that information. He hadn't been cautioned properly, apparently. Yeah. It wasn't recorded because it was an afterthought to the main thing. Yeah. So years go by, no one gets charged. And then in 2016, there is an inquest and a lot of these witnesses were still alive to give evidence. Some of the police officers were, not the one who was so adamant that someone else was guilty. And the coroner found that it was this guy.
Was he still alive?
No. Okay. But so what I think is that might give some closure to the family. Yeah. But in terms of justice, I'm like, you know.
You use this word justice, I think. You mean the criminal justice system in this country.
Yeah, have someone held accountable for it. So I don't know. The other one I'll be watching is the William Tyrrell inquest.
Yes.
I think it was due to be returned in January, but now it's been pushed out, I think, to December.
Yeah.
There
seems to be a real appetite, I've noticed in the last 5 years or so or more, that they will go and do coronial inquests on these historic cases.
Yeah.
You know, the Whiskey a Go-Go fire from the 70s, they do a coronial inquest a couple of years ago. I did a coronial inquest on Daniel Morcombe it was certainly after the trial and conviction of the man who murdered him. Yeah, because, you know, again, and that's such an important function, is that the reason they do the coronial inquest, they knew what happened to Daniel Morcombe, but they wanted to look at systemic problems in police investigations.
And I think that's great. And I love that that actually does have consequences and outcomes. I think with these, I just think, you know, Shandy's family or Lucille's family are like, this could have been a prosecution. This could have been a conviction. Someone could be punished for my missing family member. Mm. We've got it there in black and white.
Yeah.
And nothing comes forward, you know?
Yeah.
That would be so difficult to swallow.
Yeah. But I mean, all systems run by human beings are subject to, you know, mistakes, because humans are fallible.
Joseph.
You know, you just...
I just think we need to have more...
Convictions. Yes.
More convictions.
So how did I know you were going to say that?
More convictions.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went down that rabbit hole of the coroner's court. I think they do a phenomenal job. The amount of work and those... Honestly, those...
And the medical...
Reasonings of those coroners are...
But the medical evidence, I couldn't do it because they just go through in such detail causes of death. And I have too much of a weak stomach for that kind of stuff.
And I guess it must be really hard for them as well, knowing that for a lot of these cases that they are investigating, there is no answer.
No, but hopefully they are heartened by the fact that they are giving some answers to people, to family, and that.
I think they do an amazing job.
Yeah.
And they're, honestly, if you're going to read any reasons,
I think coroner's court's the place to go.
They are so clear and easy to read and,
I can't, no court of appeal judges are listening to you right now.
Well, there's not as much legalese.
I suppose that's right. Yeah, it's all facts.
Sometimes
facts,
I like facts, the facts. Legalese, but sometimes you just want the nuts and bolts of it.
Yeah.
So there you go, Joe.
That's very interesting. Thank you, Lizzie, because I didn't really know about that case. You mentioned it and I looked at a couple of things, but...
and look, I had to skim the facts. Like, it is in depth. If yes. you want to immerse yourself in the Marion Barter case, you'll be doing that for days.
Yeah. Wow. And so who knew that Luxembourg was going to be mentioned in one of our podcasts? Luxembourg. There you go.
Yes.
I wonder what's going to come out next podcast.
Oh, wait and see.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.